Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of two big stories in the news. One, the lead article in the New York Times, "Rising Gas Prices Give GOP Issue to Attack Obama," and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Dempsey's warning on CNN that an Israeli strike on Iran is not prudent. David Rothkopf, the CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy magazine, joins us to tie these threads together to determine whether the Republican Party in this election year could be both the fire brigade and the arsonist if gas prices spike later in the year and they profit from it. Then Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter Tim Weiner joins us. He has a new book just out, Enemies, A History of the FBI. We'll look into the Bureau, which is largely seen as America's police force, but is in fact primarily an intelligence agency. And we'll examine the recent and past history of the FBI and the abuses of power that its founder, J. Edgar Hoover, exercised over the many decades. Then finally, with the Supreme Court looking at Montana's challenge to Citizens United, former Massachusetts Assistant Attorney General Jeff Clements joins us to discuss whether the Supreme Court is poised to revisit Citizens United, as well as his latest book just out, Corporations Are Not People, which offers a roadmap for citizens to overturn a ruling that has led to the wholesale buying of our elections by powerful corporations and individuals. Joining us now is David Rothkopf, who is a CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy magazine. He is also president and CEO of Garton Rothkopf and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the author of Running the World, the Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power, and Superclass, the Global Elite and the World They Are Making. His latest book, Power Inc., comes out in 2 weeks. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Rothkopf.
Pleasure to be here.
And what's your sense of the premise that there could be a link between these two stories that came out today, the lead article in the New York Times, Rising Gas Prices Give GOP Issue to Attack Obama, and the remarks by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Dempsey, warning on CNN that an Israeli strike on Iran is not prudent? And it's worth mentioning that prior to this, the Secretary of Defense also suggested something similar in terms of feeling that in the Pentagon that the Israelis may strike sometime in the spring or summer, and that the Pentagon, one, would not necessarily be informed of this, and they haven't had assurances yet that it wouldn't happen. So when senior officials like the chairman of the Joint Chief and the Secretary of Defense make these statements, one wonders what's going on behind the scenes.
Well, I don't think that the Obama administration is taking a stance against an Israeli strike in order to keep down gas prices because they fear that gas prices rising might impact their election chances negatively. I think the Obama administration has been worried about the Iran situation escalating out of control for some time, and the saber-rattling by the Israelis make them feel, I think, a little bit like it's getting out of control. But just to put it into perspective, it hasn't been that long, just a couple of weeks, since you've also had Secretary of Defense Panetta saying some pretty unequivocal things about the United States not wanting Iran to have nuclear weapon, President of the United States saying the same thing. So they've been walking both sides of the story.
So when the John Boehner, apparently at this closed-door meeting last week, said this is vis-a-vis the rising gas prices, which people are already starting to feel now at the pump, $4 a gallon will be pretty much nationwide very soon. When John Boehner says this is a debate that we want to have, is he profiting from Obama's foreign policy's problems here? Because after all, the National Defense Authorization Act, the president was leery about signing it, threatened to veto it because he felt that the Republicans were pushing on him a bill that would, in fact, cause Iran to back to go to the wall and the price of gas to go up because of that.
Well, look, I think the Republicans are back on their heels. They've had a very fractious primary campaign so far. They don't have a candidate that anybody loves. The economic indicators are turning in favor of the president, the story of GM, the story of Osama bin Laden, all the things that support the president's candidacy seem to be lining up in the right way, and they've got problems. So they're, I think, shopping for a case to make. As it happens, when gas prices go up, it does have a negative impact on an incumbent, even more so, apparently, than things like shifts in GDP. But, you know, the Republicans are going to take whatever argument they can. If gas prices are high and they can go after the president, they'll do it. If Iran gets the bomb and they can go after the president for having been too soft on Iran, they'll do that, too. It's a little bit like the Republican Party right now is using the campaign season, the primary season, as a kind of giant national focus group to see which ideas actually take with the American public.
So, David Rothkopf, do you think, though, that given what we've heard so far from the IAEA and other sources, and the Pentagon itself and the CIA, about where they think Iran's nuclear program is at, do you think there's a possibility of the ultimate October surprise, which would be Iran suddenly detonating a bomb or saying they had one?
Well, all the reporting that exists out there suggests that won't happen before November. Were it to happen before November, it would be a very bad development for the president. It's one of those several externalities that could just turn the election upside down. You collapse of the Eurozone, a major downturn economically, problem in Iran, perhaps some major upset that happens elsewhere in the world, Russian social unrest or problems with stability in Nigeria. If the United States doesn't respond properly, this is going to be something that would be a problem for the United States. But the Iran one looms, I think, largest of them all, because it really is at a hair trigger point right now.
So, again, I'm speaking with David Rothkopf, who's CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy Magazine, and his latest book, which will be out in 2 weeks, is Power Incorporated. When General Dempsey says on CNN today on Fareed Zakaria's program, a strike at this time would be destabilizing and wouldn't achieve their long-term objectives, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs is referring to the Israelis. I wouldn't suggest sitting here today that we've persuaded them that our view is the correct view and that they are acting in an ill-advised fashion. That sort of has echoes of what Panetta was saying earlier. So why is the top brass in this country signaling to the American public and the world they're worried about Israel striking Iran and that they don't really have any control over Israel?
Well, there's two interpretations of that, one of them less cynical than the other. The less cynical one is that that's actually what they feel, and that, you know, the Israelis are a little more forward-leaning on this issue. I do think the Dempsey interpretation ignores the fact that long-term isn't really necessarily the Israeli objective. If the Israelis can go in and put back the Iranian nuclear program for a couple of years, they might consider that a victory. After all, when the Israelis went in and blew up the reactor in Iraq, the objective was only to set it back a year. It happened that it set it back a decade. But So, first of all, there's a problem with the analysis. The more cynical interpretation of what they're doing, however, is providing themselves with a level of deniability in the event that the Israelis do move. This is, suggested in part by the fact that, the president has said, we will do whatever it takes to stop them from getting a nuclear weapon, and then saying we're as close to Israel as we have ever been, which would mean that if the Israelis were to act, the immediate assumption around the world would be, well, they did it with the U.S.'s blessing. And I think the United States may have gotten a little bit too forward-leaning on that. And so these statements allow them to get some level of deniability, although, to be perfectly honest, I think that the people who would expect that the U.S. supported Israel on such an attack will believe it, whether the United States denies it or not.
But on the other hand, David Rothkopf, already all of the Republican candidates, those that have been winnowed out and those that remain, have all almost been sort of stepping over each other to be the first to bomb Iran and to first to suggest that the president is not sufficiently supportive of Israel. Those voices would only grow louder, surely. The APEC meeting's coming up in next month, and Netanyahu's going to come over here. So I'm sure that we'll hear more of this from Republican circles, who basically that seems to be one of their only, I don't know what they're going to really attack Obama on in substance in terms of his foreign policy, because he seems to have a pretty good record. It doesn't. What's the truth? Doesn't matter, does it, in our politics anymore?
No. Anymore. I'm not sure that it mattered when they were going after Alexander Hamilton for his, his social life back in the Washington administration either. But the reality is that the Republicans are going to probe and probe and probe, trying to find chinks in the armor of the Obama administration. One of the places that they found a potential wedge issue is over Israel. They are going to push that as hard as they can. I think ultimately it's a long-term mistake, because I think it's likely to alienate the Obama administration from some of the issues some of these people want to have supported. But they are going to push, and I think Israel and Iran are going to be two of the top areas where they push, trying to show that the president has some weakness. But as you say, after Osama bin Laden, after Libya, after al-Awlaki, after getting out of Iraq, after getting out or getting ready to get out of Afghanistan, after restoring U.S. standing in the world, it's really, really tough to go after the Obama administration foreign policy at this point.
So, David Rothkopf, what's your sense, again, David Rothkopf's the CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy Magazine and the author of the forthcoming book out in 2 weeks, Power Incorporated. What's your sense of how things are working now? Because in terms of sanctions on Iran, I mentioned the National Defense Authorization Act. The president threatened to veto it because he felt it could have the effect that we've been talking about here today, the gas prices rising in an election year. He wanted some flexibility. He seems to have brought the rest of the world along to the point where the Iranians are preemptively going to cut off oil supplies to Europe, because that's going to happen in any case in July. And they don't want to give them time to wean themselves, obviously, off Iranian oil. But these tensions, of course, have had the perverse and ironic effect of raising the price of oil already up to $120 a barrel on the Brent crude. So Iran is perversely profiting. It doesn't make sense for them to close off the Straits of Hormuz, because that would be a self-inflicted wound. What's your assessment of how the president's handling this so far?
Well, first of all, before I get to that, there are a lot of factors pushing the price of oil up, including secular demand and others. And so I wouldn't say it was all about Iran. But secondly, I think the president has handled the Iran situation just about as well as he possibly could have. Not only has he put in place a set of sanctions that actually have had teeth, partially for the reasons of good diplomacy, partially because the Chinese went along with it because they saw it as in their interest to get gas at cheaper prices elsewhere. But with the Stuxnet and with the tacit support for what appear to be a series of covert attacks against the Iranian nuclear program, the squeeze has been put on Iran in a way that it's truly feeling it, and it may have some positive effects. I think the bigger problem, frankly, is that the nuclear nonproliferation regime in the world doesn't work so well. The premise that some states should have nuclear weapons and others shouldn't is really hard to sustain, especially when there isn't an automatic military enforcement mechanism. And ultimately, the real test is going to be whether the president goes forward with some of the ideas he articulated in Prague early in his presidency about moving towards zero nuclear weapons, because that is really the only way that you eliminate the threat of country after country stepping up and seeking to join the nuclear club.
And, of course, Israel has a covert arsenal that it doesn't acknowledge, but it's estimated at up to 200. And one of the more alarming facts of our current global situation is that the fastest growing nuclear arsenal on the planet is the Pakistani arsenal, which for a small, poor country is almost incomprehensible.
Right, a country also that, you know, is divided in its government right now. And, you know, I have heard very senior officials in the United States government at the very, very top say, anybody who tells you that we know where all the Pakistani nuclear weapons are is lying to you. So we talk as though we're sure there's a lid on that, but there isn't. And the problem with Iran really isn't so much Iran getting the weapon as it triggering more of an arms race in the Middle East. And that's not because somebody assumes there'll be a nuclear war that'll follow, but it's going to be harder and harder to maintain knowledge of and control of every nuclear weapon that exists in the region. And that leads to the likelihood of a terrorist attack or some other unplanned incident that doesn't, you know, fit into the rules of nuclear deterrence as we've known them thus far.
Well, just in closing, David Rothkopf, the General Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, was asked about Syria, and he says it's a very different challenge from Libya, and basically that there's not a lot that the U.S. can do, there's no military options because the Syrian military is very capable, and conversely, arming the rebels is not a good idea and is premature. If Syria falls, of course, that would be a huge blow to the Iranians. My understanding is that the Chinese, who have made tremendous efforts to build diplomatic relations with the Arab oil-producing states, in particular Saudi Arabia, are getting an earful from the Saudis and the Gulf now about their support for Syria and the joint Russian Chinese veto and the visit of the deputy foreign minister to Syria. What's your understanding of where that stands?
Well, I think the Chinese may be getting an earful, but the Chinese are shrugging it off pretty much. They know that they're in the power position in the region. Almost every additional droplet of oil that comes out of the Middle East and its growing capacity over the course of the next couple of decades goes to China or to India. They are the growing power in the region, and they act accordingly. They have their deputy foreign minister in Syria now. He has, been making statements that sound as though he's seeking a solution. I think they've been sort of backwards leaning on this whole thing. As for the Dempsey statement about Syria, I think it's a bit of a cop-out. The reality is that thousands of people are being slaughtered, and even if there's no simple or neat solution to this thing, I think it's time that the rebels were armed. I think it's time that the Assad regime goes, and I think the only way that they're going to go is if there is some kind of military force against them. So arm the rebels, do something at the Turkish border to create zones of protection for these people, squeeze the Assad regime even tighter, and make it absolutely clear that Assad will never leave the boundaries of his country without being arrested and prosecuted as being a violator of human rights and a committer of crimes against humanity. The world has been too timid on Syria, and it's time that changed.
Well, thank you for joining us here today, David Rothkopf.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with David Rothkopf, who is the CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy magazine. He's also the president and CEO of Garton Rothkopf and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's the author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power, and Superclass, The Global Elite and the World They Are Making. His latest book, Power Inc., comes out in 2 weeks. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the FBI. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter Tim Weiner, who won the Pulitzer Prize for his work on secret intelligence and national security. He has covered the Central Intelligence Agency in Washington and terrorism in Afghanistan, Pakistan, the Sudan, and other nations. And he's the author of Legacy of Ashes, Betrayal, and his latest book just out is Enemies, A History of the FBI. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tim Weiner.
Thanks, Ian.
And this book is, most Americans think of the FBI as America's police force, but your book shows that it's really, first and foremost, an intelligence agency.
That's right, and it always has been, at least for most of the past 100 years, since it was first founded by President Teddy Roosevelt back in 1908. Yeah, secret intelligence operations against the enemies of the state, hence the title, enemies, anarchists, communists, leftists, your listeners.
you bet. each and every one of them.
That's right. You were on the enemies list, or you might have been at one time.
Well, also, though, your book, Tim Weiner, Enemies, A History of the FBI, points out that because I think a couple of National Security Agency analysts defected to the Soviet Union and it was revealed or assumed that they were homosexual, that Eisenhower ordered Hoover to do a kind of purge, and Hoover sort of equated homosexuality with communism. And
true. Hoover, and he was not alone in this, going back to the 1930s, conflated homosexuality and communism. Why? We're leading, of course, up to the $64,000 question about Hoover's own sexuality, and we'll get to that in a minute. Hoover conflated communism and homosexuality because they both had secret languages, secret codes, they met in secret places, they had secrets. This was reinforced in the 40s and 50s when, and you'll know this, Ian, Kim Philby and his aide de camp, who were working for the KGB and British intelligence, Guy Burgess and Donald McLean, were flushed out. And, of course, this went back to Cambridge and Oxford in the 30s, and there was, in fact, a nexus, wasn't there, between communism and homosexuality. This was reinforced when Hoover recruited his great informant and defector, Whitaker Chambers, is the man who fingered Alger Hiss as a communist. Chambers was an editor and writer at Time magazine, and he had been in the 30s both a secret communist in the Communist Party underground, working for Soviet espionage, and a secret homosexual. So,
along with Roy Cohn, right?
Well, Roy Cohn is a different story.
Uh-huh, I see.
That's a very different
Well, he story. Sort of overlaps with McCarthy there, doesn't he?
He worked for Joe McCarthy.
Right.
So this leads us up to the great question of, was Hoover, who persecuted gays in the government going back to 1937 and for the next 35 years until his death, rooted out gays in the government, persecuted them, hounded them, ruined their lives. Did he do this because he was a repressed homosexual, a closet case, and working out his rage on the American people? The answer is no.
So you should have told Clint Eastwood that, Tim Weiner.
It makes a great story. Unfortunately, it's not true. The entire thing is like an inverted pyramid that rests on one point. The assertion by a British journalist that Hoover liked to wear tutus, had an active but secret homosexual life, that entire assertion rests on the testimony of one convicted perjurer, and it collapses like a house of cards when you touch it.
That's Anthony Summers, right?
Yeah.
That was the Anthony Summers book, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Well, so just briefly, though, who was the perjurer?
She was the fourth wife of a bootlegger who became a legitimate alcohol distributor,
named
Rosenzeel.
Right.
His company was Shenley Industries.
Right.
And she was an unfortunate woman, and she was actually convicted of perjury before she told this remarkable story to the aforementioned British journalist.
So what about the fact that he and Clyde Tolson lived together? Was that sort of...
They were, in fact, inseparable friends.
Right.
Clyde Tolson was, of course, Hoover's number two at the FBI. They went on vacation together in San Diego at the La Jolla Resort. They played the ponies together, and Tolson was his loyal number two. And anybody who's seen the movie has got vivid memories of the two men kissing, wrestling, and then fighting.
Right.
It's a myth. It's a convenient myth. And it was used by Hoover's enemies in the government, on the right and on the left, to try and destroy him. It does not have the virtue of being true.
Well, I suppose, you know, in love and war, what is true? Nothing is true in Washington, right? Truth is a moving...
I have made an entire lifetime trying to winkle out the truth from secrets. So
sure.
I assert that there is...
Of course there is. I'm being sarcastic in as much as we live in a... It's true. The people you've been after, the people who hold the secrets, that's been your main beat.
And I try to document my work, and as you know, I put hundreds and thousands of endnotes in my books so that every quote and every assertion is documented and on the record.
Again, I'm speaking with Tim Weiner, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his work on secret intelligence and national security. His latest book just out is Enemies, A History of the FBI. And there's a couple of things that there's a great scene in your book, by the way, which filled in a big chunk of the story that I've always been fascinated with, because I recall that during the Bush era, when there was the so-called NSA wiretaps operating, there was an amazing scene where the head of the FBI and the acting attorney general, Comey, went to the Ashcroft's bedside. And in your book, I didn't realize that Ashcroft's wife had actually got a phone call from the president asking her to hand the phone over and saying it was a matter of national security, and she had refused to do so.
It's a Shakespearean scene.
It's extraordinary, yeah.
Where the attorney general is close to death, and he turns down the request from, you know, Bush's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern to authorize an illegal program, which was the president's program of electronic eavesdropping. But the even more amazing scene happens the next day. After this extraordinary confrontation, where Ashcroft, you know, like the ghost of Christmas past, raises his head from the bed and says, "There's the attorney general," pointing to the acting attorney general, James Comey, who would not go along with the Bush wiretapping program. And Robert Mueller, the head of the FBI today, who has served longer in that post than anyone but Hoover, confronted Bush in the White House the next day. Robert Mueller, FBI director, to his great credit, had written his resignation letter by hand at 1:30 in the morning, put it in his breast pocket, and walked into the Oval Office, and the head of the FBI said to the President of the United States, "Mr. President, your electronic eavesdropping program is illegal and unconstitutional. Unless you skin it back, I will resign, the Attorney General will resign, and his six underlings will resign." And Bush said, "What?" And he thought, and we have this from his own memoir, George W. Bush, he thought back to Nixon's Saturday Night Massacre, which had happened 40 years before, where Nixon went through two attorneys general and the command structure of the entire Justice Department, who resigned rather than support the obstruction of justice. And Mueller won. Bush did skim it back, the electronic eavesdropping program, but in the process, he lied to the FBI. The President of the United States lied to the Director of the FBI, and that is a felony, punishable by 5 years in prison. It was a very close thing.
So what does this say, though, Tim Weiner, in the broader question of what is the FBI and what is their role?
Exactly.
Most people, particularly our listeners here, see them as the ones that spy on Quakers and anti-war activists.
Of course they do. And that is part of their history. But
I was going to just let me just finish the thought here, that there's also this other side that story tells us. And there's also the case of Mark Felt, who turned out to be the deep throat, that was clearly felt that things had gone awry in terms of the top of the power structure, and felt that through leaking it to the Washington Post, he had to, that was his sort of patriotic duty. Am I correct in saying there are two sides of this?
You are correct. Let it not be forgotten that Mark Felt, who was the number two man and in effect the acting director of the FBI after Hoover died, was Deep Throat. He was the man, along with at least four of his senior FBI colleagues, who brought down Richard Nixon. It wasn't Woodward and Bernstein. Everything they got right came directly from the FBI. It was the FBI's evidence that sent Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Mitchell, and Dean to prison and drove Richard Nixon from the White House. It was also the FBI that stood up to George W. Bush and his electronic eavesdropping program, which was equally illegal, as illegal as the burglary of the Democratic headquarters. The rights of the people of the United States to be secure in their homes against illegal searches and seizures has both been violated by the FBI and upheld by the FBI.
So they're both the arsonist and the fire brigade.
That is right. And why is that? Because going back to the founding of the United States, we have had a struggle between liberty and security, between freedom and danger. We need to be both safe and free. Liberty and security are both necessary for a free republic, but they are opposing forces. You cannot have one without the other, and we need both, but they are at war with one another. And ever since the Americans overthrew the British king, we have had this struggle in this country between liberty and security. It is a tug of war, and the FBI is at the center of this struggle, and they have to calibrate this calculus every day, because on the one side, on the security side, you know, are the military and you know, the conservatives and the people who live in fear, who say, if you don't do this, and this being, you know, spy on people, break into their homes, steal their secrets, people will die. And on the other side are the forces of, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of the press, civil liberties, who say, if you do that, we will lose our freedoms. And to his great credit, the present director of the FBI, and this may enrage some of your listeners, but here it is, has said that if we fight the war on terror but lose our freedoms, we will lose.
So let's go to Louis Free, though, because I wanted to get to that, because I've always thought the story of John O'Neill was an extraordinary story and a deeply ironic one, given that he quit in frustration, I think frustration, right, with Louis Free, and became the head of security for the World Trade Center and died on 9/11. I've also spoken to at length with Ali Soufron, who was in many ways
a real hero.
Really, a real hero and a protege, I think, of to some extent, of John O'Neill's.
Ali Soufron is sui generis. For your readers, this is a man who worked for the FBI, who was a native Arabic speaker, graduate of Villanova, joined the FBI on a whim, and he's the man who brought down the CIA's secret torture program as an FBI agent, who blew the whistle on the CIA's secret prison and on waterboarding, an extraordinary feat. And he too quit the FBI in frustration in 2005.
So what was with Louis Free? Because I know, for example, he coddled that guy Hansen. I don't know whether it's because they were both Opus Dei or whatever it was. I think
here is the long story short on Louis Free, who was the head of the FBI throughout almost the entire Clinton presidency from September 93 onward.
And Clinton didn't speak to him, right?
Free didn't speak to Clinton.
Right.
And the reason is that from day one, the head of the FBI, Louis Free, regarded the president of the United States as the target of a criminal investigation. And being a purist and a sanctimonious man, he would not speak to the president. They spoke perhaps half a dozen times during Clinton's presidency, and not at all for a four-year stretch at the end of Clinton's presidency. This is a disaster. And it is one of the proximate causes of 9/11. When you have a head of the FBI who won't talk to the president, and the CIA and the FBI aren't talking to each other, this is a recipe for the downfall of intelligence. And you can say what you will, but about the need for intelligence and about intelligence services, but they are a fact of life, like the post office and the tax man. And they might as well be good at what they do. And to be good at what they do, they will protect and defend the Constitution of the United States without violating the rights of the people of the United States. Throughout most of history, the FBI has not been good at this. And I would argue in the last 3 years they're trying much harder to get it right.
So is this a case then, given the enormous influence and imprint, if you will, that J. Edgar Hoover had over the FBI, and then we talked about Louis Freeh's massive deficiencies, and you're, I think, without putting words in your mouth, suggesting that the current incumbent, Mueller, has been restored some of the constitutional character or what...
He's tried to put, and this is a very difficult and I think uniquely American dilemma, he's tried to put secret intelligence operations on a constitutional footing. To do intelligence under law. And that is no mean feat.
But what does it say, though, about an organization? Is it that dependent, and is it that easily shaped by the people at the top? Because I talked to a bunch of FBI people over the years, and they said one of the first things that Louis Freeh did was to tell everybody to get rid of their computer and go back to their notebooks. I mean, good Lord, if that's true, we're lucky to have survived him.
The FBI still has, as a consequence of this, less computer capability than your average 14-year-old in the United States. But that's a different issue, really.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to get back to first principles here, which is if you're going to live in a nation that has been and for the foreseeable future will be a superpower and projects its power beyond its borders, you're going to have an intelligence service. I mean, this has been true since Joshua took Jericho. A nation that projects power has spies, and therefore counter-spies, spying against the people who are spying against it. You can't abolish them any more than you can abolish the post office or abolish the IRS. They exist because this is a modern society. So you want them, since you must have them, to operate on a legal basis and to protect and defend the Constitution, as they're sworn to do, and to strike a balance between security and liberty, and to help us be both safe and free. Throughout most of its history, the FBI, because of the great power of J. Edgar Hoover and because of the long shadow he has cast in the 40 years since his death, has not gotten that right and has not operated on a constitutional basis. And to the extent that it does today, in part because we have a fan of the Constitution in the Oval Office and because we have a pretty loyal public servant running the FBI who does what the president tells him to do, they are starting to try and get it right. And as much as we fault them for their past behavior, I think we need to recognize that they are trying to do that. This may be a very brief epoch in the annals of the United States of America, but it is happening, and it gives one hope.
Well, Tim Weiner, I thank you for joining us here today.
It is always a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Tim Weiner, as a Pulitzer Prize winning New York Times reporter. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his work on secret intelligence and national security. He's covered the Central Intelligence Agency in Washington and terrorism in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Sudan and other nations, and is the author of Legacy of Ashes, Betrayal, and his latest book just out, Enemies, A History of the FBI. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about a way to overturn Citizens United.
Well, I don't figure I'll be back there for a spell. Even though Rita moved away and got a job at our motel, he still waits for me, constant on the sly. He wants to turn me into the FBI. Me, I romp and stomp, thankful as I romp. Without freedom of speech, I might be in the swamp.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jeff Clements, who previously served as Assistant Attorney General and Chief of the Public Protection and Advocacy Bureau in the Massachusetts Attorney General's Office. Jeff Clements is the co-founder of Free Speech for People, a national nonpartisan campaign to challenge the creation of constitutional rights for corporations, overturn Citizens United versus the FEC, and strengthen American democracy and Republican self-government. His latest book just released is Corporations Are Not People, which argues for a constitutional amendment overturning Citizens United versus FEC. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Clements.
Thank you, Ian. Glad to be here.
And it looks as though something's happening here with this Montana case that could actually, one of the problems with the constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United is that constitutional amendments are very high bar, deliberately set by the founding fathers. And of course, two-thirds of the states, or is it three-quarters, have to sign on. So that could take years. But something's happening up in Montana where the Montana Supreme Court upheld the state's 1912 Corrupt Practices Act in December, which in effect rules that the United States Supreme Court's Citizens United decision, essentially the Montana law strikes that down on a basis of a compelling state interest. And the plaintiffs in that case, the American Traditions Partnership, then took it to the Supreme Court. And, of course, of all people, the person who gets to hear it is Justice Anthony Kennedy, the swing vote who made Citizens United possible. So where do we stand? Because last Friday, Justice Kennedy asked Montana to reply by Wednesday to the plaintiff's request for overturning the state ruling. And a couple of the Supreme Court justices, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer, suggested that this might be an opportunity for the Supreme Court to revisit Citizens United and perhaps overturn it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think what we've seen in Montana is a sort of a more formal resistance to Citizens United of the same kind we're seeing across the country. And Montana had the opportunity to stand up to the dangers of Citizens United and the idea that corporations have the same rights as people and could spend unlimited money in elections. They were able to do that largely because the Attorney General there, Steve Bullock, said, I'm not going to be the one to just roll over and let our state law, which has banned corporate spending in elections, go down after a century. It was a law that Montana people enacted by referendum back in 1912 after being dominated by, by the copper corporations. And so he defended the law, the Western Tradition Partnership, now calling itself the American Tradition Partnership, essentially a corporate front group, sued, as you said, Ian. And amazingly enough, the Montana Supreme Court sided with the Attorney General and said, that's right, Citizens United does not mean that the Montana law is unconstitutional, and now it's going to the Supreme Court. So Justice Kennedy did oversees that part of the country for the circuits and referred the matter to the full court, and that's the decision that just came out Friday evening and said that the Montana law is stayed, the decision of the Montana Supreme Court is stayed, which means essentially it's put on ice. The Supreme Court has said to Montana, not so fast. But there's a couple of silver linings. One, as you mentioned, is Justice Ginsburg and Justice Breyer make what is truly a remarkable statement after only 2 years of a decision being in effect. They say that it is no longer credible, frankly, to say that independent corporate expenditures do not have a corrupting effect or the appearance of corruption in elections, and that it's time to reconsider Citizens United. So that's only two justices, but there'll be further proceedings now. What the Western Tradition Partnership will have to file what's called a petition for certiorari, which means a more formal request that the full court hear the case, and then the full court will decide whether to take it or not. Now, it's a tough road. Citizens United does have a big impact on the states. It's certainly the court intended to make sure that no Americans could make the rules that corporations can't spend money in elections, whether under state law or federal law. And so it's going to be a big uphill climb. So I think it's way too early to take the amendment campaign off the table. It is a tough road to do a constitutional amendment, but it is first unlikely the Supreme Court will reverse Citizens United right now. And second, I think that day will only come when people show we're determined to get the constitutional amendment if the court does not change direction.
So, Jeff Clements, when Justice Ginsburg says a petition of certiorari will give the court an opportunity to reconsider whether, in the light of the huge sums currently deployed to buy candidates' allegiance, Citizens United should continue to hold sway. And then she said, the Montana experience makes it exceedingly difficult to maintain the independent expenditures by corporations do not give rise to corruption or the appearance of corruption. She's just basically pointing out the obvious. That's, anybody that looks at television or opens a newspaper nowadays can see the effect of Citizens United via their super PACs. And one of the great ironies is that we've just gotten used to the notion of the 99% versus the 1% in terms of who holds sway and power in this country, the 1%. But now it's only a fraction of the 1% that's actually controlling our elections via super PACs. Somebody put it at 0.00063%. So you're saying, though, that even though the justices have said this, that the four that lost in the decision, one of them, of course, is already retired, they don't have sway. Why would the five and Kennedy, the swing vote, be able to resist? Or is it because it's done and they don't want to revisit it? They don't want to be overturned? I understand judges don't like being overturned. Give us a sense of what is the resistance there at the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I think the resistance, Ian, is that it was obvious to almost everybody before Citizens United was decided that money has a corrupting effect in elections, that the very wealthy are the ones who have the most to say and make the biggest contributions in elections. We had this rule about corporations that had been on the books for a century, and there was already then, of course, a problem with corporate power, but at least there wasn't unlimited corporate spending in elections and the birth of the super PACs, which Citizens United created. So that is the problem, that I think there are five votes who essentially say, let the facts be damned. I mean, when you read Justice Kennedy's decision in Citizens United, it is a little bit of fantasy land, frankly. I mean, what Justice Ginsburg is responding to is a statement made in Justice Kennedy's original decision saying, essentially by fiat, he says corporate money and spending does not have a corrupting effect. Well, all the facts at the time were to the contrary, but it didn't matter. He also said, oh, we'll have disclosure. We don't have to worry. There'll be disclosure. There isn't disclosure. That just doesn't happen. He says we're not saying anything about foreign money coming into elections, but of course corporations, especially the ones that have the capital to spend in a sort of pay-to-play political system, are international and global, and you have corporations like the News Corporation spending money, $1 million to the Republican Governors Association, and the number two shareholder there is the Kingdom Holding Company of Saudi Arabia. So the only way the result will be different is if one of those five justices change their minds. Otherwise, we'll have another 5-4 decision. I'm certainly hopeful. I mean, we filed a brief in the Montana case, Free Speech for People did, And, you know, we're watching this very closely, and we'll be working with others to, if the court does take the case, to brief it and make sure that every argument is made and that the court has every chance to come to its senses and reverse the Citizens United decision. But, you know, so far there's not a lot of indication that those five votes, and you need, you know, it's a nine-member court, so five votes is a majority, that the five who are in the majority in the Citizens United case see the world differently than they did then.
Again, I'm speaking with Jeff Clements, who previously served as the Assistant Attorney General and Chief of the Public Protection and Advocacy Bureau in the Massachusetts Attorney General's office. Jeff is the co-founder of Free Speech for People, a national nonpartisan campaign to challenge the creation of constitutional rights for corporations, overturn Citizens United versus the FEC, and strengthen American democracy and Republican self-government. His latest book, just out, is Corporations Are Not People, which argues for a constitutional amendment overturning Citizens United versus FEC. So, Jeff, just to try and get an understanding of the minds of the five Supreme Court justices who made this extraordinary ruling in the light of obvious evidence to the contrary that corporations and corporate power doesn't hold sway and corrupt in elections and have a disproportionate effect as money, overwhelming the votes of people. Which, and then once these floodgates were opened by Citizens United, it's apparent to all but, you know, somebody that's living on a different planet that the effect is detrimental. I recall when shortly after Citizens United, during the State of the Union, President Obama castigated the court for that ruling and pointing out the very things that you just said. It'll have a detrimental effect. Corporations will be able to buy the elections and foreign money will be able to come in and there'll be no accountability. He made that point. And as you recall, Justice Alito said, mouthed, not true. So what's Alito talking about? So this is what I'm trying to get at. They seem to have some peculiar ecumenical abstract belief here that doesn't gel with the rest of humanity.
Well, yeah, and that's an interesting way to put it. I do think it is almost theology, and I hasten to say I think it is a not conservative philosophy. And my book tells the story of where this sort of corporatist thinking came from, and it's really been happening for 25 to 30 years, and it is not necessarily the same as the conservative movement, and I think we need to make that distinction. Justice Rehnquist, a long-standing conservative, actually dissented in a lot of the cases that built the framework for this idea of corporate speech rights. And so in my view, there's a majority on the court right now, including Justice Alito and the Chief Justice, Chief Justice Roberts, that have a corporatist point of view of the world, and it's not necessarily conservative. Remember, Citizens United only happened because Chief Justice Rehnquist died and Justice Sandra Day O'Connor retired, and Alito and Roberts came on the court. They reversed a decision that was only 6 years old, the McConnell case, which had upheld the very same law that the Citizens United Court struck down. So I think what we have is just a very corporatist mindset that thinks of corporations as something they're very much not, just a, groups of people, thinks of corporations as forces for order and in the world, and just is blind to the dangers and the severe dangers of a free republic of equal people turning over what are human rights to big global corporate entities, which are very much not humans. They're tools at best. And so I think they really have ideological blinders on, and that they, I hope they come around. I think partly the very important point of this constitutional amendment of courts pushing back like Montana did is educational, and the Supreme Court is not immune to what Americans think. And so hopefully they'll come around, but I think that is part of the problem, is that it's very ideological, a sort of corporatist ideology, and it's sometimes hard to have people see facts clearly when they're somewhat blinded by ideology.
I don't get this, though. My understanding is that back at the time of the Founding Fathers, to get the 13 colonies to join in into the United States, the first compromise that had to be made was to allow elections to be state controlled by the states. They couldn't get everybody to join in unless they had that right. So they've never federalized elections, really. And I don't understand how in this case where you've got the state of Montana challenging the Supreme Court, why, you know, they're all supposed to be the conservatives on the Supreme Court, are all supposed to be big states' rights guys, right? Which, of course, was the great irony of Bush v. Gore, where they completely repudiated their ideology.
It is quite shocking. One of the shocking things about Citizens United is you have two areas that are traditionally prerogatives of the state. One is the elections, as you mentioned, the idea that the federal government comes in to say what kind of election rules the state should make to make free and fair elections is a radical departure, really, from the original conception. And certainly, you know, the departures we've seen have usually been where grave injustice has been done. Things like, you know, the Jim Crow laws, where African Americans weren't able to vote. You know, that was a healthy assertion of federal power in the Voting Rights Act in order to ensure free and fair elections. Here we have an assertion of federal power to prevent the states from having free and fair elections without influence of corporate money. But the other thing is the corporations themselves are largely under state law, that most of the largest corporations that we think of are incorporated in Delaware for various historical reasons. The idea of corporation laws in general have long been prerogatives of the states to decide, and these corporations have state charters, generally speaking. So you have, again, an aggressive assertion of federal power by judges who claim to be respectful of federalism and state, the appropriate place for states' rights, essentially overriding two big areas of state prerogatives, corporate law and election law, and in order to have global corporate money pouring in. It just doesn't make sense.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Jeff Clements.
Thank you, Ian. It's been great to talk with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Jeff Clements, who previously served as Assistant Attorney General and Chief of the Public Protection and Advocacy Bureau in the Massachusetts Attorney General's office. Jeff is the co-founder of Free Speech for People, a national nonpartisan campaign to challenge the creation of constitutional rights for corporations, overturn Citizens United versus the FEC, and strengthen American democracy and Republican self-government. His latest book just out is Corporations Are Not People, which argues for a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United versus the FEC. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Nicholas Walrath. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.